Hello and welcome back to UEG Journal Podcast, your quick dive into the latest and most impactful research in gastroenterology. I'm Dr. Mohsin Subhani, Trainee Associate Editor of UEG Journal and Clinical Assistant Professor of Gastroenterology at University of Nottingham, UK.
And I'm Maria Manuela Espinho, Trainee Associate Editor of the UEG Journal and Gastroenterologist in Porto, Portugal.
We're back for episode two, and we have picked out five interesting papers from the latest issue of UEG Journal.
Yep, and as always, we'll keep it short and sharp. In under 20 minutes, we will walk you through the key takeaways and what they might mean for your daily clinical practice.
Grab a coffee, join us for a fast and focused roundup of what is new in GI. All right, let's kick off with our first article. This is a European consensus guideline on malabsorption. It was led by Professor Sabatino and team with 10 scientific societies on board and experts across the Europe. The guideline was presented in two parts. In this episode, we will concentrate on part two, which focuses on three big areas, and that are screening and special population, nutritional supplementation, and treatment goals, and lastly, the role of primary care.
So let's begin with screening. Mohsin, who should we be testing?
Anyone with unexplained iron or B12 deficiency, chronic diarrhea, type 1 diabetes, infertility, premature osteoporosis should be considered for malabsorption and primarily should be screened for celiac disease. And as once a wise gastroenterologist said, if you're waiting for obvious signs to think malabsorption, you are already few bowel movements behind. And don't forget first degree relatives, patients with celiac disease, even they are symptom free, they're at higher risk.
Yes, and autoimmune gastritis also deserves attention, particularly in the elderly with pernicious anemia or young adults with an unexplained iron deficient anemia, right?
Exactly. And if you see chronic diarrhea in someone post cholecystectomy, ileal resection, or with IBS type D, always think about bile salt malabsorption. CCAT does help diagnosis, but in the setting where it's not available, a try of bile salt sequestrance can be helpful, better than guessing and waiting.
And of course, don't forget patients with GI symptoms plus diabetes, HIV, or alcohol overuse. They may as well have exocrine pancreatic insufficiency.
And also be alert of sprue-like enteropathy in patients on only sartan, ACE inhibitors, or immunotherapy. Sometimes culprit is sitting right in the medical cabinet.
So now let's move to special populations.
In kids, malabsorption often hides in plain sight. Celiac disease often be tested using TTG and IgA. And if total IgG TTG is greater than 10, a biopsy might not be needed. And also keep in mind exocrine pancreatic insufficiency, carbohydrate intolerance, intestinal failure, as early detection changes the long-term outcomes.
And in older adults, don't dismiss vague GI symptoms as just aging. EPI and celiac disease together account for up to 60% of malabsorption cases. And what about B2 deficiency and folate deficiency? These have huge implications and are indeed very treatable.
And in women, especially after bariatric surgery or with pregnancy loss, always screen for nutritional deficiencies, celiac disease, including B12 and folate. It does make a difference in management.
All right. So what's the approach to diagnosis, Mohsin?
This guideline actually does provide a very structured diagnostic algorithm separately for adults and children. Always start with history, a range of different laboratory investigations, and don't forget the stool investigations. Then tailor second line test based on the clinical clues.
Okay, now for the key clinical takeaways. So the first is that we should all think malabsorption early, especially in patients with anemia, diarrhea, or unexplained infertility. Second, we should screen proactively in high-risk groups, including relatives of patients with celiac disease, post-op GI cases, and as well in the elderly. And third, tailor nutrition. We should start with oral support, but escalate to enteral or parenteral nutrition when needed. And of course, micronutrient monitoring is essential.
And don't forget the frontline. Primary care is core of managing patients with malabsorption and long-term support.
Our next paper is entitled Calprotectin in Patients with Perianal Fistulas in Crohn's Disease and Cryptoglandular Fistulas and was developed by the UMC team at the IBD Center Amsterdam. We know that perianal fistulas can arise from Crohn's disease or can be cryptoglandular, meaning that these later ones are unrelated to Crohn's. The challenge here is that they can appear quite similar, but their treatment paths and prognosis is different. And this is where fecal calprotectin comes in. Previous studies suggested it could distinguish Crohn's-related fistulas from cryptoglandular ones, and this new study prospectively validated this idea and took it a step further by analyzing calprotectin levels in the fistula tract itself.
Interesting. So this study recruited 63 patients undergoing surgery for active perianal fistulas, and both stool samples and local fistula sampling scrapings were collected during examination under anesthesia.
Yes, and the results showed that fecal calprotectin levels were significantly higher in Crohn's disease patients than in cryptoglandular cases, suggesting that fecal calprotectin remains a reliable marker to distinguish between the two groups.
Interestingly, fecal calprotectin correlated with active luminal inflammation, but not with local calprotectin levels in fistula itself.
Which brings us to the scrapping results. Local calprotectin did not differ significantly between Crohn's disease and cryptoglandular patients.
And this is the key. Scrapping calprotectin was associated with fistula severity as measured by top class classification, which stratified Crohn's fistula based on treatment goals and outcomes.
Indeed, patients with high calprotectin in scrapping were more likely to be in class 2C, which had a worse prognosis with a very high amount of patients eventually needing a stoma. In contrast, those in class 2A or 2B had low calprotectin and better outcomes.
There was also a correlation with T2 hypersensitivity in MRI, further supporting that scraping calprotectin might reflect biological activity of fistula.
So, it is a subtle but potentially powerful biomarker, and this test is accessible. Calprotectin is already routinely measured in clinical practice, and the same ELISA study can be used also to evaluate calprotectin in scrapings.
Well done, Manila. So, most importantly, while discussing this novel use of scraping calprotectin, we should not forget about limitations, such as smaller cohort size, especially in cryptoglandular cohort. And also, the top class system is still unvalidated. So I would say there is still a bit of time until this will come into routine clinical practice.
Yes, of course, Mosen. So the big take-home message here is that fecal calprotectin does indeed distinguish Crohn's from cryptoglandular fistulas, and that indeed scraping calprotectin may help to predict diagnosis. Yet, of course, further information in this regard is highly awaited.
So keeping on our legacy for fecal calprotectin, just let's explore another novel use of fecal calprotectin. But this time we're moving away from the gut to a liver-gut interaction. So the paper we're going to talk about is around fecal calprotectin that might help us better predict outcome in patients with advanced chronic liver disease.
Yes, this study led by Thomas Kohler and colleagues looked at over 260 hospitalized patients with advanced chronic liver disease and using data from the RH7 registry. What's the big question here? Can a single fecal calprotectin measurement help us spot high-risk liver patients earlier?
Exciting. So we know the fecal calprotectin is already heavily used in IBD, but its role in liver disease is less established. What the study found is pretty compelling. A higher fecal calprotectin level was independently associated with greater risk of adverse outcomes, which were defined as either liver transplant or death within 180 days.
And what's really interesting is where fecal calprotectin shines, not necessarily in the sickest patients, but in those who appear relatively stable. For example, patients with lower MELD scores, without refractory ascites, with Charpentier class A or B. In these patients, a high fecal calprotectin level still flagged significantly elevated risk.
What I particularly found very interesting that if fecal calprotectin levels were higher than 11 times of upper normal limit, that should the patient had 2 to 3 times higher risk of poor outcomes. That is a potential red flag we otherwise would have missed using the traditional scoring systems.
So instead of waiting for the MELD or CLIF C scores to rise, a fecal calprotectin measurements might give us an earlier warning and, of course, more time to intervene in these liver patients.
And of course, don't forget that this is not perfect. This is very early. This was a single center study, but future does hold some promises.
Yes, right. And the practicality is a plus. Fecal calprotectin is non-invasive. It's already used widely in GI clinics, particularly in IBD, and its measurement is relatively cheap.
Great. I think the key question or key important message would be how we can convince our friendly hepatologist in using poo test in their routine clinics. Well, the take home from this clinical study are fecal calprotectin is a strong independent predictor of death or liver transplant in advanced chronic liver disease patients. And if your levels are greater than 11 of upper normal limit, that can be used as a prognostic score.
So next time you are reviewing a cirrhotic patient who looks okay on paper, maybe ask yourself, have we checked their fecal cal?
What I'm going to say would please my GI luminal colleagues that what come out in the stool often tell us more than what we see on the labs.
On that note, let's move to our next article.
So the study we're going to discuss next was led by Kareem, Hamish and colleagues. Very important topic that evolved around training conditions for ERCP around the Europe. So this was a survey which was distributed to trainee across Europe to understand current barriers to the training and current state of training for ERCP.
So this survey captured responses from 649 participants across 35 countries, including trainees, trainers, and experienced ERCP practitioners. And what's the key message? That there's a major gap between recommended training standards and current practice.
And interestingly, when we're talking about ERCP in any setting, there are a lot of disparities with some high volume centers compared to low volume centers. And that's what we have seen in this survey. Over 80% of respondents agreed that a structured training based on defined key quality metrics is essential, but only 13% of the trainees reported having access to such structured programs. That shows the disconnect and discrepancies among the ERCP or endoscopy training across different regions.
Indeed, Mohsen, particularly when we consider procedural volume. Despite guidelines recommending a minimum of 200 to 300 ERCPs to achieve competency, over 70% of trainees reported performing less than 50 ERCPs per year. And in lower volume centers, this percentage rises to 83%.
And yet, two-thirds of the trainee agreed that ERCP training should be centralized to high-volume centers, those performing at least 200 ERCPs annually, but still more than one-third of the trainees are receiving training in lower-volume centers that don't meet this threshold.
And perhaps even more striking is the lack of performance training. Fewer than half of institutions regularly monitor key quality indicators such as cannulation success rates, and adverse events, including post-ERCP pancreatitis. I believe that without this feedback loop, both training quality and patients' outcomes may suffer.
This study illustrates the pressing need for alignment between training, vision, and actual implementation. Structured curriculum, supervision by experienced ERCPists, and rigorous key performance index would only improve the quality metrics, but will improve the quality of training.
So taken together, what should we take away from this?
So the three takeaways that I took from this paper is that ERCP training need to be more structured and uniform across different centers. And this is important and pivotal in reducing differences across different centers. Should be centralized within high volume centers. So this can be met in line creating advanced fellowship in these centers and inviting more trainees from the center where there is volume of the ERCPs done on a day-to-day basis is low. And also ensuring there are quality metrics that have been taken up nationally, which I'm sure in UK we do for every unit. It's mandatory for us to report our KPI to JAG. The similar approaches can be adapted in other centers within Europe.
Yes, so ultimately this study is a call to action, right, for academic centers, training bodies and professional societies to standardize ERCP training across Europe and ensure that vision is matched by reality.
So just to finish off in this article, this was an interesting survey and does open up a debate which we need to involve multi-stakeholder in designing the curriculum for gastroenterology trainee within Europe.
So let's finish today's episode with a deep dive into the study, which reminds us what happened to the patient after an acute episode of pancreatitis. We will be looking into a Swedish population-based study titled Long-Term Mortality in Acute Pancreatitis. The study was led by Daniel Sleen and team. They included over 89,000 patients who had first episode of acute pancreatitis between 1990 and 2019 from Swedish pancreatitis cohort, and they survived initial hospital admission. These patients were compared to over 900,000 matched individuals from general population without any history of pancreatitis. So what the study shows, and actually this cohort with acute pancreatitis compared to people without pancreatitis from general population had higher risk of mortality, and it was as high as 37.7% compared to 29.8% in the control group. And risk persisted even after adjusting for other factors like cancer and chronic pancreatitis. It's important to highlight that episode of severe pancreatitis, development of chronic pancreatitis, and non-gallstone-related pancreatitis had increased a risk of mortality. And there was also indication people from deprived population were more at risk compared to people from more well-off neighborhoods. So what does that tell us? This tells us that an episode of acute pancreatitis is not an end. These patients do require a tailored approach and a long-term follow-up with personalized management plan. We need to look at holistically manage the comorbidities and tailor treatment as compared to individual needs of patient.
So, all right, that's a wrap for today. We'll be back soon with more fresh science from the UEG Journal. And until then, may your endoscopy reports be clear and your biomarkers precise.
And of course, don't forget to like, subscribe, and share with your colleagues. Thank you for listening and staying with us.